Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Loveline is meant for an adult audience. Loveline may contain sexually oriented content. Listener discretion is advised. Loveline with Dr. Chris starts.
3, 2, 1.
Now.
All right. Happy Thursday, everybody. My week is winding down. I hope yours is too. And the weekend's coming. So in case I forget, let me just remind you all, set some self-care goals. Decide right now. Take a moment. Moment of silence. Oh, that's all I can give you. I don't like dead air on the radio. But pick three self-care goals this week. And remember, it doesn't have to be anything massive, nothing you have to spend money on. Just three things you're going to do this weekend that have nothing productive based. It's not lazy either, because we don't use that word laziness. And it's just about nourishment and recharging. Set some goals. Now, we talked about this once before, but this came across my desk and I'm absolutely obsessed. So maybe some of you are tuning in for the first time. A dating trend called foodie calls. And that's when a date is just in it for the free meals. This is the kind of things that break my heart. Right? Like, we have so much to deal with on dating apps and in the love and romance world, right? People ghosting, people being heavily narcissistic, people having double lives and having a marriage somewhere that they don't tell us about. And now we got to worry about people just going on a date with us because all they want is the free meal. I mean, that's going to make everyone like, yo, splitting, everything's a split, 50-50. No one's taking anyone out for dinner ever again because, yes, people are going out on dates just to get free drinks and free booze and free food. I mean, on one hand, I kind of get it. You know what I mean? But on the other hand, I'm like, that's a gross misuse because people are rolling into dates. They're single. They want love. They want companionship. And then they find out that their date was just in it for the food. My heart breaks. Good news, though. The world's first transgender professional boxer is now the face of Everlast. This is epic. This is epic for a couple reasons. Not just because it's Everlast's first transgender professional boxer that's leading their campaign, but also because boxing is such a hyper masculine culture, full of a lot of toxic masculinity that, like, Everlast, props to you guys. So, I mean, basically they picked Patricio Manuel to be the first. It's called Be First. That's actually the name of their campaign. And this is also the first transgender boxer to compete professionally. So, interesting story. As a woman, Manuel was a USA national amateur boxing champion and was invited to compete in the 2012 Olympic trials. And then due to a shoulder injury, changed everything. And Manuel was recovering from the injury and decided to transition. And it proved to be, as he says, the toughest fight of his life. He was shunned and abandoned by the gym he had worked out at and also the trainers he had worked out with. My heart breaks around that. And had to fight the boxing commission to recognize and change the regulations around transgendered individuals in the sport. So this person is blazing trails. And this is amazing. I'm looking at his photo. I mean, my God. Like, well done, sir. Manuel fought his way back in the sport and became the first person to compete in professional boxing as a transgender fighter, then also heads Everlast. Mind blown. And in a quote from his own mouth, "I'm incredibly honored to have been selected to tell my story in Everlast's Be First campaign. Everlast is such a fixture in the sport, and to have such an iconic athletic company recognize me as a professional boxer is a dream come true." Could you imagine? Actress dropped from The Color Purple over anti-gay posts. Ready for this? She's going to sue. Now, the surprise twist is the role in the production that she was dropped from was for her to play an LGBTQ character. What? So how are you going to get a role, a gay role in a play and then say something anti-gay? And then when you get dropped, which is very understandable, you then want to sue. What are you suing for? Being a bigot? I don't know. So actress claimed that homosexuality was a choice and refused to take part in London Pride and then was shocked when she was dropped from the production of The Color Purple. Oh my gosh. But, you know, she's going to sue. I love this. I love this. Surprise twist left and right. But the reason why this is such a problem is because of this story. And this is why, like, the fight goes on. Because, again, some people think, like, oh, the battle's been won. People can get married. Michigan is now going to allow adoption agencies to turn away LGBT couples. My heart breaks. So basically what they're doing is they're putting prejudice and bigotry in front of children getting homes and parents. Do you know how many children there are that need to be adopted? And these loving couples are not allowed to give these children homes because of agencies' religious beliefs. Again, the religion should be led with care and compassion. And again, the studies show over and over, and I posted these links on my social media, that same-sex couple raise healthier children in a lot of psychological areas. Higher levels of compassion, better communication skills, higher levels of acceptance of diversity. The kids thrive because parents don't need, kids don't need opposite-sex parents. Kids don't need two parents. What kids need to be psychologically healthy and lead healthy lives is loving caregivers. And that can be of any gender and any numerical number. So that's heartbreaking. Michigan, get your stuff together. The battle doesn't end. And also finally, and I love this one, and this is something that we've talked about a little bit. We're going to talk more about. You've all heard of Bonner's. It's a really well-known cleansing product that you can use on your floors and also like on your face. I mean, you can do everything with it. So Dr. Bonner, led by David Bonner, it's an all-in-one soap. Literally, you can use this like on the floor, in your hair, on your face. I think you can like brush your teeth with it. They're donating $150,000 and they're going to match funds for psychedelic research. The money will go to the Oregon Psilocybin Service Initiative, an organization run by psychotherapists petitioning to legalize the use of psilocybin, that's magic mushrooms, for therapy use in Oregon because it's been shown to really, really, really help. And they want to legalize and also help train practitioners to help individuals. It's had really good side effects. I mean, that's the thing. Look, the addiction field, the field of psychology, and also culturally, we have to get more comfortable with the use of plant medicine. It's happening fast and furious. So we're going to be covering that and tracking that, more from that soon. Question of the night's up on our Loveline IG page. So weigh in on that. You're listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. This is Loveline with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, we're back. So let's talk about something that, you know, there's these buzzwords that get slung around a lot of times in psychology and therapy. And we talked a lot about self-care on Loveline. It's one of our favorite things. I want to try to remember on the end of every week on the show to kind of help everyone remind themselves to set some self-care goals for the weekend. But let's talk about the other buzzword that goes around a lot, boundaries. You know, people talk a lot about others generally having good or bad boundaries. And what's really important to remember is everyone's going to have a different understanding of what's appropriate. And someone's boundaried health is really shown when we set one and we see what they do with it, right? Because, you know, again, I am very sex positive. I'm very body positive. And for instance, I think that talking about sexuality and sexual anatomy is always healthy, that we need to get more comfortable with those terms, that it empowers people to be comfortable with those terms at all ages, that these are natural, healthy aspects of life. Some people don't like that boundary. So, but my boundaries allow for that. And we all have different boundaries around different things. Now, when I set a boundary with someone and I let them know, hey, I'm not okay with ... or I'm not open to whatever, what they do about that tells me how they are around boundaries, right? So often we have to set one first because our boundaries are different. And hopefully if someone's healthy, they'll ask for clarity if they're confused, but more importantly, they'll honor the boundary that you're setting, right? So it's important to always set one first. Now, we often struggle with what's an appropriate way or time or topic around which to set a boundary. And so what a lot of people end up doing is getting really, really burnt out. And I want to remind people, when you're feeling frustrated with someone, angry with someone, or burnt out, sometimes it's because we're not setting boundaries, because other people are taking us at our word that if we say we're okay with doing something or we allow something, they're assuming that they're honoring our boundaries. And in order for us to take care of ourselves, we have to sometimes ask people to be different around us, or we have to be different ourselves, right? We have to take care of ourselves. So one of the things that's important is realizing that when we set boundaries, we're protecting our time, right? And we're also helping ourselves to not get exhausted by certain people that are in our lives. and that there's a difference between hurting someone and harming someone. And we'll get back to that. So one of the things that comes up is a lot of social media and email and telephone. And I remind all the patients in my practice that if someone calls them, that doesn't mean they have to answer. If someone's left them a voicemail, that doesn't mean they have to answer or listen to it. If someone texts them, that doesn't mean they have to respond. An email, the same thing. You get to decide who you respond to. You also get to decide when you respond. For some people in our lives, they might reach out when they want, but we might not be in the right mood or space to receive them or to bring them in psychologically. Because remember, even if someone's not physically present, when you respond to a text or you listen to a voicemail or you read an email, you are psychologically spending time with them. You're psychologically bringing them in. So there's people in your life that really are disruptive for you or you're trying to set some distance from. Remember, let them go to voicemail and you don't have to listen to it if you're not in the right space to hear it or read that email. I often leave many voicemails unlistened to, emails unresponded to, and text messages not read because I'm not in a space where I want to be engaged or I'm not in a position where I want to engage these specific people. And it might be hours, days, weeks, or even months before I go and I open it. So that's the first thing I want to remind you. Just because someone writes you doesn't mean you have to write back. Just because someone calls you doesn't mean you have to answer, right? That's us setting a healthy boundary. Also, you know, we want to look around touch boundaries. And we've talked about this on the show before where, you know, there's certain mental health areas like AA where people are very huggy. Some family members and friends are very comfortable with physical contact. And if so, they go for that contact. I wish people would ask first and say, hey, do you hug? Because not everyone does. But it's okay to let someone know, hey, you know, I'm not very comfortable or open to physical contact. I've shared before, and this is not the most powerful example, but I'm covered in tattoos, and sometimes people think it's appropriate to lift up my sleeve without asking to just look at my tattoos and my body, and that's very uncomfortable. And I've had to say to people, hey, please don't touch me without asking, or please don't pull up my shirt sleeve without getting permission. And what will sometimes happen is people that aren't used to boundaries will look offended or hurt, but healthy people will say, oh, of course, or I understand, or thank you for setting that boundary with me. And that's another way that we learn about people's boundaries and health. So take that for yourself. If someone sets a boundary with you, always thank them. Thank you for taking care of yourself. Thank you for setting that boundary. That's a healthy sign. That means they actually want you in their life. They're trying to take care of themselves so that you can stick around and they can stay connected to you. Really, 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 really important. So remember that you get to set your boundaries. You get to decide who and how and when someone's brought in. Check in on your mood. Am I in a place to connect with this person or hear this message? You know, I've even told clients if someone reaches out and they need advice or they need support and you're having a rough day, it's okay to say, hey, you know what? I'm not really in the right space to help you, but please reach out to someone who might be. Please reach out to another friend or another family member. I myself am having a rough day or a rough week and I just can't be there for you. Another really important, healthy way to kind of take care of yourself and set these boundaries. Because again, that's part of self-care and that's part of being in a relationship, right? Is being able to tell people that something they're doing is negatively impacting you or affecting you, right? And asking for them to be different. So, you know, the bottom line is just remember, you don't owe anyone interaction. You get to decide who you speak with, when you speak with them, and kind of how they're brought in. I mean, that's an important part of just general self-care and mental health and well-being. So practice that. And just also notice maybe when you're feeling really resentful or angry at someone because of how they're being present in your life, and look at how maybe you've allowed that and you haven't set boundaries because they're just assuming all is well. Our question of the night's up on our Loveline IG page, so weigh in on that. And when we come back next, we're going to talk about the differences between gender binary, gender queer, and gender nonconforming. These words get people very confused. Listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. 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 This is Loveline with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, we're back. Question of the night is up, as always, on our Loveline IG page. So weigh in on that one, and we'll be breaking that on down later in the show. And, of course, doing a little couples therapy because it's Thursday. A little of a tongue twister there. All right, so let's talk about gender for a minute. You know, this is very confusing to a lot of people. The labels, the signifiers, the way we talk about gender is always an evolution, and I find that to be a really stunningly beautiful thing. Why? Well, because it's honest. And here's the thing about labels and terms. What they do initially is they give people a sense of normalization. It gives people a way to better understand themselves. And that's really, really, really powerful. Anyone that's a minority in our culture, it's really meaningful when they have a way to understand who they are outside of standard cultural norms, right? Second is when you have a label or a name for yourself, you're then able to connect to community. And that is highly valuable for mental health, because connecting to community is A, just a bunch of support, but also, again, another tool of normalization. You feel part of something. You have others reflecting back to you that you have worth. You see through others how you can be, and it just really increases your self-worth and your self-esteem. So labels are really, really important. Now, for those of us that are in dominant culture, either we are, you know, white, hetero, or cisgendered, aka, you know, comfortable with the gender that we've been assigned at birth, we don't have to worry about these concepts because the entire world has been structured around us, centering us, reflecting back our worth and value. We are constantly being related to by seeing ourselves in commercials, on billboards, at the supermarket. And so it's hard for a lot of us to really understand what's going on with people that are trying to find terms and concepts to make sense of who they are, to feel normal in the world, and also to find ways to connect with others. And so when people get frustrated because I don't know what to call people anymore, it's really disheartening because what they're really saying is, you know, I don't want to take the time to learn. They're saying that their own confusion is more important than someone's sense of worth or sense of self or feeling valuable and acceptable in the world. And if someone tells you this is how I prefer to be seen, or this is what I want to be referred as, or this is the word I want to be called, it's an act of care and compassion to say, I hear you, I see you, and I'll do that for you, even if it's confusing. And for some people, they're worried about making a mistake. Listen, We it's difficult in the beginning when someone's changing how they want to be seen or referred to, and you can lovingly own your mistakes and apologize and try to show up and be as supportive as you can. Now, the words are constantly changing. And, you know, I always tell this to people that in my private practice, if someone comes in and they identify in terms of gender or any kind of sexual orientation, my follow-up question is always, tell me what that means to you. Because just if someone says to me, I'm gay, I don't know what that means for them. And I'll say, tell me what that means for you. And sometimes they'll give understandings that are far beyond or outside of what a lot of us would have assumed based on stereotypes. There are some gay people that still actually have sex with people of the opposite gender. There are some people that identify as hetero, but they still have sexual experience with the people of the same sex. They just don't identify in that way. And so it's really important when someone talks about any kind of term, especially mental health terms. Someone says, I'm sad or depressed. What does that mean to you? Tell me what that looks like so I can really relate better and understand who you are. But more importantly, to really just offer validation and care around that. So none of these terms are necessarily written in stone. And none of these terms, am I giving a fully inclusive understanding of what they are. But these are like a starting point, because I always want us to ask people to explain to us who they are. So that we can have a better understanding. So the words that are commonly thrown around right now are gender, in terms of gender, there's gender binary, there's gender non-binary, there's gender queer, and there's gender non-conforming. And again, a lot of these things are more like a constellation that kind of intersects and interweaves with each other, right? So not necessarily distinct categories. And thankfully, gender and a lot of other language terms are constantly evolving. And that's a really beautiful thing because it expands and it allows itself to include more people. So basically, again, there's no concrete definitions. Everyone's going to have a different interpretation for themselves. And that's like a really important component of all this, is for people to be able to self-identify. So non-binary, in most simplistic terms and concept, means someone who doesn't feel comfortable or doesn't identify with just male or female. And that's what we mean when we say the binary. So you're male or you're female. If you're not one, then you're the other. You're one of the two. But there's a lot of people that occupy space in between those two terms, outside of those terms, or even both of those terms, sometimes at the same time and sometimes cycling back and forth. One of the most powerful things I'll tell people in my office when they're struggling with gender is, or even sexual orientation, is you don't have to decide. It can be an ongoing journey, and it can be something that's always kind of fluid and active for you. But non-binary just means I don't feel comfortable with the concepts of maleness or femaleness. Those are not necessarily how I see myself, or those are terms that I don't like having used to apply to myself as to who I am. Genderqueer now becomes an even larger umbrella that has a lot more creativity, diversity, and fluidity within it. And that's often for people that are kind of playing with gender. They're purposefully not trying to necessarily have a landing point, and they're really trying to live in a non-normative state. And it's really about, for some people, being kind of chaotic and not being really clear to other people. Again, it's this performative, deliberate playing with, messing with the boundaries of. There's a lot of really powerful activism in that. Gender nonconforming kind of bumps into that as well. That's someone who, the way that they present or live in the world in terms of behavior, fashion, interests, goals, or how they see themselves or want to be seen, is, again, not really conforming with anything. There's no term necessarily in gender that would really align with who they are. And these are really powerful concepts, because gender is a really in our culture thus far, a really powerful signifier for making sense of who we are. I mean, think about it. How many times in a day are we asked about our gender? Some people might say never, but then you'll encounter these moments where on an intake form at a doctor's office, while buying an airline ticket, an application for a job or an apartment, and even just people in the world, when they look at a baby, they always want to know, is it a boy or a girl? And it's an interesting question, because what is it you're trying to understand or figure out with that term? Because if a parent says, oh, this is a little boy, you've actually learned nothing about them still. You know, it doesn't necessarily communicate anything. We still need to take time to get to know people, but we use these gender terms as though they explain something. And also, it's interesting of note, is often the only thing we'll remember about someone is their gender. You might not remember their name, you might not remember what they look like, but we'll often remember at least what their gender was, because it's that powerfully ingrained in our socialization. So sit with all of that, let that marinate. Coming up next, we're going to be sliding into the DM, so still some more time to win our question of the night, but coming up, the DMs, we'll be breaking down some of your questions. You're listening to Love Line with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Love Line. This is Love Line with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, we're back. And now it's time to slide into those DMs. Sliding in the DMs is brought to you by our friends at Trojan Condoms, because it's a big old sexy world and we want you to explore it with confidence. All right, here we go. Hey, Dr. Chris. So my wife confessed that she cheated before marriage. She was, she was remorseful and regretted it and was crying when she told me, but I'm not really sure where to go from here because I love her, but infidelity is a deal breaker for me. Is forgiveness something you can learn? I'm worried I'll hold this against her subconsciously if I forgive her. I'm happy that your wife came forward to talk about it. Again, a sign of a healthy relationship is the safety to share with our partners things that are happening and that might be distressing, right? I want people to be in relationships where they both have worked on creating an environment where we can bring things forward that might be hard to hear. That's the sign of a healthy relationship, the ability to make each other uncomfortable sometimes so that we can understand where we're at, what's going on in our relationship. So I applaud you and her for doing that work, because that's a big disclosure. Now, I don't think that that should be a deal breaker. You're telling me you loved her. You've gotten married, which tells me that if we're operating from the traditional concept of marriage, that you've committed to working through things as best as you can until you've realized it's not workable. And I think that this could be workable. I'm not sure why, you know, again, here's the thing. Let's also talk about this quickly. An apology, one that is reasonable, is when someone says they're sorry, acknowledges what they've done, has empathy for the impact they've had on you, and also takes accountability around how they're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. And if someone does that, I want people to err on the side of accepting that, because people are going to make mistakes of various kinds. Cheating is problematic. Cheating is very traumatic. It's a sign of immaturity. There's a multitude of ways to handle whatever it's a symptom of. I wish people would go to each other and say, listen, we need to talk, and that they could call out whatever the issue is and work on it miles and days and weeks before anything like that would even happen. People don't always do that. So what's going on in your relationship that this person thought that that was the best solution? Is it something that they need to work on? Is it something that the two of you need to work on? That's a question I want you to ask yourself, because there is something to be learned from this. You might not stay with this person, but I want you to look at what might have been your role in creating a relationship or an environment around which that happened. And maybe you'll realize you had no role, but I want you to explore that. I also want you to try. If you love this person and you're married, see if work can be done. This is something that would require couples therapy. I'd want you guys to be working in a professional environment with a therapist and looking at what created this, what caused this, what work there is to be done, what other circumstances might have been going on in your relationship. I don't know, right? There's so much more to this than that. But can forgiveness be something you learn? I don't think it's something you learn. I think it's something you work at. And there's going to be days where one would be triggered, days where it's more difficult and it comes up again, days where it's more solid and you're more confident. So it's going to take some work. It's ongoing. You know, again, our brains operate from an associative place. And so these triggers will come back. But yeah, if you were to do the work and you were to get into couples therapy and you're using this to recommit, then you can't hold it against her anymore. That's part of the work. You either release her because it's beyond what you can handle, or you renew and you recommit. And part of that work is essentially at some point letting it go, and it becomes your own internal work. When you've chosen to renew and you're going to stick around this marriage, and if she's done her part and continues to, then sometimes it's going to be your own struggle in your recommitting that you're taking on that you have to work through when you're feeling uncomfortable or triggered. You can't always hold her accountable to that or punish her forever, right? So at some point you got to push forward. So the assessment is, can you really do that? But I would definitely get into some couples therapy around that. So there it is. Sliding the DMs is brought to you by our friends at Trojan Condoms, because it's a big old sexy world and we want you to explore with confidence. We got our question of the night up on our Loveline IG page, so answer that. We're going to be breaking that on down later in the show. Listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. This is Loveline with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, it's Thursday night, which means it's time for some couples therapy. So we got Rebecca Sheet, a licensed therapist, with us. Rebecca, what's going on?
Hi, how are you, Chris?
Oh, you know, doing my thing. Just doing a little love line, no big deal. So I wanted to bring up a topic that I thought was really interesting. And this is born out of a DM that we got, and it has sat with me. And so I want you to kind of unpack those with me a little bit. So we got a DM where a girl was writing in, and she wanted to know if it was problematic / offensive after her boyfriend, who she's in a monogamous relationship with, had just gone on vacation without her. I don't know the details of that, but maybe went away with friends or family. Maybe it's early on in their relationship. And she said, upon coming back, I just don't know that I trust him. Is it okay if I ask him that if he's clean, which is a problematic term to use around STIs, and to ask him to get an STI test? And I went through the idea that, like, look, people that contract STIs or STDs, they're not dirty. They're not broken, dirty people. You know, that's possible. People get illnesses, viruses, bacteria. Mm-hmm. So let's not use those words. But I said, if you're in a relationship with someone you trust, well, my gosh, they have to be able to go away on vacation and not have you thinking that that's a sexcapade for them.
Right.
So is the work, I said to her, is the work that you need to learn how to trust, or is it that you're dating someone that's not worthy of trust and you shouldn't be with them?
Right. I guess I would wonder about the latter, which, yeah, I mean, is there a reason why you don't trust this person? Have they given you some reason not to? Is there evidence of cheating in the past? Has the trust not been rebuilt? And maybe that's why. Or are they also maybe experiencing some leftover trauma from a past relationship and bringing it into this one? I mean, it would be interesting to find that out. I mean,
right. And it's hard not to bring in stuff from the past.
Right.
Like
right.
Even people like you and me who work in the field and we try to be better than others. Like, it's really humanizing and normalizing when I realize, like, oh, wow, that was from an ex.
Right.
That's not this person right here.
Right.
Like, I still bring that stuff forward. It's so hard. And, like, God bless your next relationship. I hope to God you find someone who's so far away from narcissism it's not even funny.
I know.
But that's another topic.
Yes. we're good with the narcissist.
We will circle back and do another segment on narcissism, dating a narcissist, how to, you know, we'll get into that again. I promise you. We'll have your moment.
Okay.
But, yes, the current relationship will always in some way pay the price from damage from before. And that's interesting because and tell me if you see this a lot in your practice, trust and the anxiety around it, it seems more so now than ever. And I was wondering if it's because of just people dating online and technology. And so now with your phone, you have the ability through DMs and these platforms to have a new outlet for poor behavior.
I definitely think so. I mean, it's interesting too, just to see my kids who are teenagers and the way they manage relationships. Like, we could be sitting at the dinner table and everyone's looking at their phone. There's a decrease, I think, in just human contact and interaction and presence. The presence a lot of time is physical intimacy. I'm sitting next to you, I'm having dinner with you, but we're all on our phones, so we're not really together, right? And so in the past, you know, I remember I had a pager. I had a voice, you know, message machine.
Gosh,
I had like
pager.
A cool, like, push button phone, and, you know, before it was rotary, and you'd run home, check your voicemail, pick up the phone.
I would use a payphone while out to check the voicemail at home to see if my crush had left a message or call.
Oh, so see that?
Remember those days?
Yeah, that you know, people were meeting people more organically, and if you needed a fix or you needed to soothe, you know, you didn't have a cell phone attached to you. Now you do, and the dating apps kind of, I think, really make it a lot easier to get a fix.
Let me ask you this: so what you just said about your children, and they're kind of the age where they're dating. Yes, they're old enough to date.
Old enough to, but they're not. I mean, yet.
Are they teenagers. Courting and flirting?
I mean, they flirt, okay. And like they'll say they're hanging out.
So do you see it done differently because of the ability? Are they? Do they have like? What I'm asking is, are there more people they're flirting with because via the phone they can reach multiple people? Where like there was a time where we only had access to who's living in our school.
Right. No, that's true. Right.
Do you see that?
Like, yeah. I mean, numbers? So my kids, they're obviously they have more like, you know, followers,
right,
whatever. They can
right.
talk to more kids
right.
or different kids at different schools. But what I also see, and maybe I don't know if this is particular to my kids, but I'm finding that people are less likely, like at least the teens, to be sexual early because they are more distracted with technology and they can Snapchat and this and selfies. And I feel like before we were maybe more bored. So
are they more distracted with technology or are they more self-obsessed?
Oh, yeah.
Or is
there's
it both?
That. I mean, there's definitely both.
Because the studies are showing that sex
sure.
has dropped.
Well, and I think, I definitely think I've seen that with my kids.
Yeah,
you know, I want to think that it's partly because I'm a really good mom and I'm arming them well with good knowledge. You know, they've learned
sadly,
from my bad behavior.
Not.
No, I'm
technology
an mom,
and self-obsession. That's the best sex educator.
But they really, I feel like, are making good choices and
that's
they're
good.
Slowed down
that's
a
good.
Bit. Yeah. So I think that's a good thing.
They also have more information readily available, right? Where, I mean,
right.
I don't know what we used to do back in the day if we had a question about about anything sexual. Like, what would we go to the encyclopedia?
Well, I
but
remember
now
I went
just
to my parents.
Oof, that's a rough one.
I'd be like, you know, first time I had sex, I'm going upstairs.
But
I have my birth control.
I know, again, we all have interesting relations with our parents, but you have a mom that's pretty honest, forthcoming, and
right.
like she probably got real with you.
Right.
Like,
my parents were very
phobic.
Okay. Yeah, my parents were both very open about sexuality. Like they were both physicians, and your dad was a physician.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they would sit at me at the table.
But your mom
talk
also has an amazingly open, forthcoming personality.
Yes.
She's all in. I've heard the things she said to you before. So that's also in there too.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. They're just circling it back to the whole trust piece.
Yeah.
Is it's harder to trust people. Everyone has more abilities via technology to engage in problematic or gray area. So people's guard is a little more up.
I think
it's just
people are more disposable too.
Yeah, for sure. That's understandable too. That makes you anxious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder, did she talk about, I mean, I don't know if she went into it, but did she talk about the fact? Yeah,
did
I was
not.
Just curious
it was
about
just the general
whether she had like something happen.
Yeah,
with
I don't know all the backstory, but it was an interesting topic that I can't even feel secure in my boyfriend going on vacation when I'm not there. And I thought, wow,
that's
really going to be a long haul.
Right, right, definitely.
All right, well, Rebecca, where can people find you?
They can find me at RebeccaEshita.com and HungryBecca on Instagram.
Beautiful, I love it. All right, we'll see you next Thursday.
Okay.
All right, question of the night. It's up on our Loveline IG page. As always, listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. This is Loveline with Dr. Chris.
On Channel Q.
All right, y'all, we're back. Question of the night's up on our Loveline IG page. But right now, it's time for some Freak on the Streets. All right, what do y'all got for me tonight?
What is considered a normal sexual appetite?
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. I like questions like this because a lot of us, you know, one of the things I've seen having worked in the field for almost two decades is a lot of what people come in asking about can be collapsed down into this general question of, am I normal? Everyone just wants to be normal. And you can't be, right? Because there's so much diversity and creativity in the human experience, especially around sexuality, that I always try to move people away from that. And I say to them, don't try to align with normal. Don't compare yourself to normal. The work is really about just having confidence in who you authentically are and how you operate and presenting that. So when someone says, what's a normal sexual appetite? I'd say, well, what's normal for you? And that's kind of what I want you to get really confident in, because I can tell you what the average is. But remember, any average, any statistical average is going to be the center point. There's people that are going to fall. A vast number of people are going to fall on either side of that, less and more. And that doesn't mean that those people are inherently unhealthy, but stats tend to imply that, right? That if you are more or less than what the average person does for, you know, how many calories a day they eat, how many hours of sleep they get, or how much sex they're having, or how much money they make, we tend to try to want to align with that. But again, just because you are more or less doesn't imply that there's something wrong with you. So there's no right level of sexual appetite. And even taking it further, we now know that there's some sexual orientations, right? Because sexual orientation is not just about the gender you're attracted to. It's about all the things that turn you on and arouse you and the desire you have. Some people are less sexual. Some people, their sexuality really is born out of and drives from relational intimacy on a non-sexual level, and it develops. And some people are on the asexual spectrum, where they don't necessarily have their own sexual desire, but they'll have sex for reasons because their partner's interested in sexuality, or they feel the need to have release. But some people don't have a true quote-unquote sex drive. And so for those people, there's nothing wrong with them. I don't want to pathologize them. So I never answer questions about what's the right amount, dot, dot, dot. I would say really get confident in the sex drive that you have and find people that are compatible with that sexually, or just present yourself as you are and find someone who can accept that. Great. What else we got?
Can monogamous love feel free?
I love these questions tonight. Can monogamous love feel free? Yes. You know, there's so many different relational styles and configurations and different boundaries we can have between ourselves and our partners. And monogamy is one of them. It's been the gold standard for a very long time. And happily and luckily, that's changing because that's not right for everyone. Some people struggle way too much with monogamy. And I'm talking to those out there that have tried and they're constantly cheating or struggling with not cheating. Monogamy is not for you. It's not, there's nothing wrong with you. It's that you're trying to fit into a system that's not correct for you. But monogamy can feel free. In fact, monogamy should. Monogamy shouldn't be about you struggling. Monogamy should be something that you freely choose because you want to, because it makes sense for you. Right? And so if it doesn't, then really ask yourself, what's that about? Is it the person you're with? Is it about the rules that you've chosen around your monogamy? Because we've talked about this on Loveline, and we'll talk more about it. The concept of toxic monogamy doesn't mean that monogamy is toxic. It means that some of the ways people run their monogamy is toxic, because monogamy should be something that the couple decides for themselves. What are their boundaries going to be? And everyone, it might be different, and it should be different. So you want to kind of talk about what monogamy should mean for you so that you don't feel trapped. It should feel freeing. It shouldn't have to be limits. And some people see it that way, or some people make it that way. And there's a lot of freedom that can be found within it. And it's just got to be something you choose. So just ask yourself, is it that you need to reconfigure the boundaries around it? Is it the person you're with? But, yeah, being with a partner, it should be more explorative, expansive. There's someone else to teach you things, show you things. So really try to kind of expand that, you know, and build upon that. But it shouldn't have to be something that's exhausting. Good luck with that. Question of the night. It's coming up next. So you got a few more minutes to weigh in on that on our Loveline IG page. You're listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. This is Loveline with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, we're back, and now it's time for question of the night. All right, so tonight's question is, what's the worst thing that you overlooked about someone? Let's see what you all got. Their lack of social media. Isn't that interesting how someone not having a social media account is something that inherently is a red flag these days? I think it's actually a good sign that people are no longer interested in the consumerism that's a part of that, the body shaming, people flaunting how much money they're making and their consumerism and materialism. And I don't know. I think there's a beauty in that. I think there's actually a lot of mental health and people not wanting to partake in that. I feel the same way, though, about people that don't watch Real Housewives. I never understood what people get out of that crap. Okay, someone else said things that they overlooked in a relationship, their terrible work ethic in love, life, or labor. Wow, that's actually a big thing to overlook. Someone's terrible work ethic in love and life. Work ethic and love. I mean, that sounds like this person is literally not even showing up or providing anything. That's horrible. Someone else said verbal abuse. Yikes. Someone else said emotionally abusive, manipulating, jealousy, overall just an insecure boy. Yikes. That's like a quadfecta. I don't know how you overlook all that, but hopefully moving forward, you will now know what those signs look like and you'll move forward. Someone else said, while on our date, I saw him texting another girl, setting up a date with her. Yeah, that's heartbreaking. You'd think he could at least go in the bathroom to do that, or do that the next day or later that night. I mean, that's horrible. How did you finish that date? What do you even do at that point? I guess that's one of those things where you have to actually call it out. Like, hey, I noticed that you're texting someone else about a date. I wouldn't be able to just sit silently. I was on a date once, and the person, we had gone on a couple of dates, and they showed up with a hickey, and they were trying to hide it. And I'm thinking, they're uncomfortable hiding it. I've seen it. I'm calling it out. I was like, so it looks like you got a hickey. And they felt really bad. And I was like, well, we're just dating. You know what I mean? Like, we're not monogamous or anything. So glad you're out there having fun, but you don't have to keep trying to hide it because you're not doing such a great job. Just talk about it. Someone else said he didn't want a serious monogamous relationship and also had drug abuse. Yeah, that's rough to overlook. I mean, the monogamy thing, I don't know. I think sometimes, again, when we meet people wherever they are as a starting point, on one hand, we have to believe what they're telling me, you know, telling us that they're open to and wanting. On the other hand, that's what they're saying upon just getting to know you. And sometimes as relationships deepen or your value to them has more meaning, they're more willing to possibly change a structure that initially they weren't looking for. But again, that's not promised either, right? But it's the reverse as well. Even if this person had said like, oh, I'm down for marriage, kids, monogamy, home ownership, that can change for them too. You know, a year down the road after you commit, where they realize actually don't want any of those things. So, you know, I guess the lesson is you meet people where they're at, but you always have to be open to the possibility of them changing. Somebody else said, oh, yikes, I can't read that one on air. Someone else said possessiveness. Yeah, that can be rough for a lot of people. Some people love that. I actually don't mind a little possessiveness. To me, there's like something erotic about some of that. So I value that sometimes. As long as it's not toxic, it can be cute. But for you, not so much. So don't overlook that again. Now you know more about what you're looking for. Someone said broke and unmotivated and resentful when things are going well for you. Yikes. The unmotivated part's really hard. And the resentfulness when things are going well for you. You really want someone who's going to kind of celebrate and participate in your life with you. You know, you don't want to date someone who's threatened by you, right? It's like a cooperative thing. We're in this together. You'd think that they would, when you have a success, they feel like they have a success. That's a rough one. How fast he had an orgasm? Not even a minute. Yeah, you know what? That one I'm not okay with. That's really body shamey. People have different nervous systems and different levels of arousal. When you're highly aroused, you have a sensitive nervous system, you're going to orgasm fast. People can't do anything about that. You know, he could equally say that you take too long to orgasm. Maybe he's the perfect speed and you take too long, right? Like he could pathologize you just as quickly. Be easy about that. When you guys are talking about the way someone's body looks or functions, people don't have control over that. I'm not okay with that one. Someone else said, things they overlooked in when they were dating, she was living with her ex-husband so they could co-parent their kids. I mean, that just is, they were trying to co-parent. Kids often come first in some relationships. I don't have to tell you. I can understand what it might be rough for you. But again, if you're with someone that you trust and love, you deal with what's going on in their lives. And not everyone's going to have a very normative configuration. And so not the right person for you. But I could see wanting to live with the kids that I'm co-parenting. Separate bedrooms, but I could see wanting to have some, you know, some level of a family unit. I don't know. Someone else said things I overlooked when dating someone, they moving in with their kid's mother a year into our relationship. Again, is that because they were co-parenting or they needed somewhere to live? I mean, I need more details on that. Other things to overlook, they said alcoholism and a developing drug habit. Yeah, don't overlook that. Those are red flags. Those are two things that give you permission to leave immediately. Someone also said how long it took to meet their friends and family. Some of y'all real harsh. I mean, okay, I guess you wanted to meet them sooner. I don't know what felt like too long. I mean, some people, it's a very powerful symbolic moment. And so they want to make sure that the relationship really has some, you know, sustainability before they kind of bring other people into their life. I don't know. Someone else said meth habit. We got a lot of drugs and alcohol going on here. The fact that he doesn't want a relationship and I do. Yes, yes, that's real. Someone else said things that they overlooked in someone they're dating, not meeting his mom when he lived at his mom's house. Yeah, I mean, again, some people move slow. I move fast in those ways. Like even if I haven't known you for an hour, if we're out, my friends are out, you might meet them and they might meet you. Why? Because you're in my life in that moment. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be there the next day. But, you know, people meet people sometimes. I don't know. But it's interesting to hear how sensitive everybody is. Other things I overlooked while dating someone, someone said excessively drinking, talking negatively about people they dated. Yeah, that's a big red flag for me. Both, actually. Excessive drinking, but also talking negatively about people they dated. That means they don't, you know, they don't leave relationships lovingly. And also, they date really problematic people. But also, oh man, it's a red flag because they're going to be talking about you that way someday. All right, y'all. Thanks for those that participated. Coming up next, we'll be sliding into those DMs. Listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. This is Loveline with Dr. Chris
on channel Q.
All right, time to slide into the DMs. Sliding the DMs is brought to you by our friends at Trojan Condoms, because it's a big old sexy world and we want you to explore it with confidence. All right, here we go. Hey, Dr. Chris, I just wanted to ask if you had any advice for people with borderline personality disorder and how it'd be easier for them to date. I have borderline personality disorder and I have sometimes let my fear of abandonment and some other issues scare my potential partners away. So I just want to ask you if any tips on how we can manage our conditions. I don't necessarily believe in borderline personality disorder. I think that, again, the personality disorders are often overused. I'd have to really sit more with you. A lot of people have those traits. We all exist on the spectrum of narcissism, borderline, ping pong back and forth. So I don't really support the use of disorders in that capacity. But I'll say this, I'll speak to the fear of abandonment piece. You know, scaring potential partners away. I don't know what the specific behaviors are that you're engaging in that are possibly scaring them away, but the work is really on just self-awareness. That's the best we can do. What are the behaviors that you potentially engage in that scare your partners away? And you have to really work on minimizing them and not acting those out. People that are looking to be in a long-term or healthy committed relationship, you know, again, they want to be with someone that they feel safe and secure with. Fear of abandonment. The reason why I don't believe in personality disorder in that way is because a fear of abandonment might actually just be a result of trauma. I'm more of a trauma-informed therapist. I think that addiction is a trauma response. What we call personality disorders are trauma responses. And I think these labels are often really pathologizing and violent. So fear of abandonment, that might be from a trauma. And so I would do some trauma therapy. You know, what's driving that? Is that real? Maybe you in the past have been. And so it's understandable that you're still in a very fight or flight based mode. And you really need to do some somatic work and trauma work to really kind of start to soothe your nervous system. But again, just really develop some self-awareness and self-regulation around what are these behaviors that I continually act out that scare my partners off. And also really work on self-soothing, that when you're feeling activated, that you do practices of self-care that can kind of calm you down so your executive functioning can come back online. When we're very anxious, we're very overwhelmed, we're not thinking from our executive parts of our brain, and we're not able to really perceive what's happening. Because if it is just a fear of abandonment and you are chasing people away and it's not that they're doing anything problematic, then it is all about you really being able to settle down and talk yourself through that. So good luck with that one. All right. And finally, someone else said, Dr. Chris, what can I do if and when my partner is depressed? This is a tough one. You love them. You know, people that are struggling with mental illness, they get to be in relationships with people. You know, we all bring something into our relationship. Depression is very hard relationally to be around. I get that. So a couple of things I would say. Number one, set some boundaries, you know, with yourself as to how much you're engaging in this, because you don't necessarily want your quality of life heavily impacted. So you're going to need time apart. So I'd say one, set some boundaries. Two, you get some time apart. Three, don't necessarily let his mood or her mood infect you. If you're having a good, supportive, loving, positive, fun day, you're allowed to maintain that. Just because your partner's depressed, you can be very supportive and empathetic, but you yourself don't have to drop into or mirror their depressed mood. And number four, talk to them about getting care. If your partner is suffering with massive depression, then that might mean they need therapy. And also some medication. If they're not willing to do that, that is when you get to say, I can't be in a relationship with someone that's struggling with these issues and isn't willing to work on them. But if they are, you stand by them and you love them. And again, you really focus on taking care of yourself and letting them know that you're there to support them if and when they need you, which sometimes isn't really the case. But believe me, I empathize with you. It's a very difficult position to be in. But, you know, take care of yourself and take care of them. All right, sliding into DMs is brought to you by our friends at Trojan Condoms, because it's a big old sexy world, and we want you to explore with confidence. That is our show. We'll be back on Monday, 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And as always, our show is podcasted at wearechannelq.com. So have an awesome weekend. Focus on some self-care. Set some goals for yourselves. You know, make a 3-point decision as to some self-care goals you're going to set for this weekend. And remember, self-care does not have to do with productivity or work. It does not mean the gym. It means things that have no productivity. They're not depleting. They're energizing and relaxing. And have an awesome night. And thank you for hanging out with me. Have a good night.